You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
On this week's tour around the NL Central, the Cubs make a move to bolster their bullpen, but the acquisition they made caught some people off guard. Jameson Taillon just might be the toughest hombre in all of Major League Baseball, and will hand out some first-half awards for all five NL Central teams. We kick things off this week with Cubs reporter Kerry Muscat. And Kerry, thank you for joining us today. And Kerry, we are not even 24 hours removed from a pretty significant trade that Theo Epstein pulled off, at least in terms of the bullpen construction. The team acquiring lefty Mike Montgomery from Seattle. And Montgomery, under the radar guy, but very good this year in Seattle. A 2.34 ERA. He is death on lefties. They're only hitting 164 against him this season. What's interesting, Kerry, is that they do have two lefties in the bullpen now. Clayton Richard, who just came back. They've got Travis Wood, who's been pretty steady all year. So how much does this shake things up with the acquisition of Montgomery?
Well, it's a great question. And unfortunately, because we're talking on an off day and doing this podcast then, I don't know what's going to happen with the lefties. The trade was announced after everyone had left the ballpark on Wednesday. And we won't get an idea in terms of the roster moves until Friday before the Brewers series. But what I do, you know, they're not going to move. They're going to keep Travis Wood. Travis Wood is kind of their do-everything guy, so they'll keep him for sure. Clayton Richard hasn't looked good, but he also is coming back from the injury, so he probably just hasn't gotten into a groove, so I don't know how that works either. They do have two young pitchers who have options left, so they could just go. They could keep Montgomery, keep Wood, keep Richard, and then Spencer Patton and C.J. Edwards could go down. You know, they're young. They can always use more time. But I do know that Madden really likes Carl Edwards Jr. and what he's done lately. So all of that will be sort of sorted out on Friday.
And, Kerry, what's interesting, too, is that, you know, for weeks with the trade deadline rapidly approaching on August 1st this year, we've heard the name Andrew Miller discussed quite a bit in terms of being linked to the Cubs. And just in general, outside of Miller, some other big names that maybe the Cubs had their eye on. So if you had to guess, and I'm asking you to guess, now that Montgomery is in the fold, does Theo Epstein still go after some of those bigger names? Or does he think that, you know, he's pretty much set and he's plugged one of the bigger holes on this team?
I don't see them going after a big name, and I don't see them going after Andrew Miller. And I guess mainly they're trying to be very careful and not disrupt the what they have right now, if that makes any sense. I'm probably not explaining that very well. But you don't want to trade an Addison Russell because you want to make sure that you take care of the chemistry in the current team and the way things are going right now. They like a lot of those players. The trade with Montgomery, sure, they lost two really good minor league kids and Dan Vogelbach and Paul Blackburn. I'm not downplaying those guys. But the Cubs are trying really to be really careful in terms of who they give up to get what they want. And Theo's also very conscious of he likes to make moves early. He doesn't want to be doing, you know, making a deal at the last minute just to get something done. He sort of prefers getting a little bit of a head start on this competition. So I could see them just being set unless they find somebody to help maybe off the bench a little bit. I think that might be an area that should be addressed.
And like you said, because we're discussing matters on an off day, we'll see exactly what the bullpen configuration and the pecking order becomes when the Cubs resume play on Friday against the Milwaukee Brewers. So again, trade pulled off on Wednesday. The Cubs bringing in lefty reliever Mike Montgomery in a four-player trade with the Seattle Mariners. And Kerry, to backtrack a little bit, the Cubs just took 2 out of 3 from the Mets at Wrigley. And even though the Cubs lost, the only game the Cubs lost in the series was the one that Jake Arrieta started, I got to think that that was the most pleasing development out of the three games, is that Arrieta looked like Jake Arrieta again. And I read something you wrote, I believe, a couple days ago that I think Arrieta said he just needed to clear his head for a couple days and not even pick up a baseball, which he did for 3 or 4 days, and voila, he gets back on track. Was it that simple for him? And talking to him after the game, you know, what kind of turned things around?
I think he just needed a break. I mean, I think all of us need a break. And he just, he just needed some time to sort of reset and recharge. The All-Star break was terrific for him. He didn't pick up a baseball for 4 days, and he just sort of he said that when he came back and threw his first bullpen after the break, he said he felt, you know, brand new. And I know Joe Maddon was joking that he probably felt like the first day of spring training. I'm not sure that. I would think that Arrieta probably had a little more command than he did the first day of spring. But it's just sometimes these guys just need sort of a time off to just sort of catch their breath. And I think that was the best thing for him.
Yeah, that was the elixir for Jake Arrieta. 7 innings and 1 run. He got a no decision against the Mets. And I think he set the league record, the major league record this season for the fastest pitcher to 25 strikes, took him all the 27 pitches. That's a remarkable ball-to-strike ratio. So Jake Arrieta looks like he's back on track, and one guy that's been on track pretty much all year is Kyle Hendricks, Carey. He was, again, outstanding yesterday as the two homers from Anthony Rizzo did not hurt as the Cubs took the rubber game against the Mets. What's interesting about Hendricks, he's been, you know, mortal on the road, but at home, the guy's been superhuman. As you wrote, 7-1 at Wrigley this year, a 1.36 ERA. Maybe I'm looking a bit too far ahead, but assuming things stay status quo and the Cubs are playing baseball deep into October, would Joe Maddon be the kind of guy, the kind of strategist to say, you know what, I've got to get Kyle Hendricks as many home starts as possible, whereas, you know, you might say Arrieta and Lester always go 1-2, but again, given how dominant Hendricks is at Wrigley Field, could you see him shaking things up a little bit to maybe put Hendricks behind a guy like Arrieta in a postseason pitching rotation?
Oh, in the postseason, sure. I thought you meant in the postseason. Yeah, they could, you know, tweak away, you know, and have Kyle start. I'm sure they would prefer to have him start at home. I mean, that's always been much better. I'm trying to get through July, so you're looking in October. I haven't looked that far ahead yet.
Well, it's certainly something to consider if you're Joe Maddon, because Kyle Hendricks has been great at Wrigley. All four of his scoreless outings this year have come at the friendly confines. We'll see where that leads us if the Cubs do indeed qualify for the postseason. And, Carey, with that, we're going to wrap things up today by handing out a couple of first-half team awards. We're going to hand out the Cy Young. We're going to hand out the Raleigh Fingers Award for bullpen. We'll hand out the MVP among position players. And then we'll ask you what the most surprising development has been for this Cubs team in the first half. So we've talked about Arrieta. We've talked about Hendricks. We've talked about John Lester a little bit. I got to think that those three guys would be in the mix for the first half Cy Young. And it's a very interesting, vote here on your part, because, you know, maybe the knee-jerk reaction is to give it to Arrieta. John Lester, save for two, rough outings back-to-back, has been brilliant all year. And then we've talked about Kyle Hendricks. So, again, assuming that those are the top three nominees, who gets your award for the Cubs' first half Cy Young?
Well, it's kind of hard to not vote for Arrieta because he did throw the no-hitter back in April, and it's kind of hard not to vote for Lester because he went 4-0 in June, and his numbers in June were amazing. But to be perfectly honest, I'm going to go for Hendricks just because he has to be the best fifth starter in baseball right now. And what he's done is his numbers at home, the way he's just showed so much maturity. And what's so much fun to watch is just how he's just smart out there. And there's been a lot of talk that it's kind of like a young Maddox type thing where he's not overpowering and he's able to locate, and that's the key. And it's just, I give him the Cy Young just because it's just been so much fun to watch how he's developed and watch how good he's become and how much confidence he's gotten over the course of this first half.
Mark, let's dive right in. The Reds took the rubber game against the Braves by a 6-3 final, and Anthony DeSclafani was really dealing 8 innings by Disco, as he's called. 2 runs for that game, and he runs his record of 5-0. And I know that, you know, sometimes the fans and even us in the media, we get too caught up in saying, you know, okay, this guy's an ace, this guy's a number three, this guy's a back end of the rotation guy. But given all that, from what you've seen from DeSclafani thus far, again, he's 5-0. Is this the guy that has the inside track to emerge as a true bona fide ace somewhere down the road for this team?
It's certainly possible. I mean, when they traded for him before last year, you know, he kind of projected as a middle of the rotation guy because he didn't have like hitters away stuff, but he ended up being pretty consistent. He's one of those guys who's very able to give you a quality start, 6-7 innings, and he went through his struggles. It was his first full year last year. It wasn't perfect, but he had some really nice outings, went 184 innings. It was definitely promising. Going into this year, he's just taking it up a notch. Except for one start, every other start's been at least six innings. He's had two that's going on eight innings. And he's just throwing strikes. He hasn't allowed a walk in like 21 consecutive innings. So, yes, he does have the future ace possibility on him. But with the number one caveat being, when you want from an ace is you want him to throw a lot of innings, and he's able to do that. So I think coming off the oblique injury, it wasn't positive that he could either be what he was last year or even better, and he's really shown that he can.
Yeah, he certainly has. And again, he is 5-0 in his abbreviated time here in 2016, but he has certainly looked good and very consistent, as you said, all season long. And, Mark, it's interesting. You can draw a lot of parallels and comparisons between him and Cody Reed. As you said, DeSclafani last year had his growing pains, his ups and downs. You knew that the talent and the stuff was there. He just had to put it all together. Now you look at Cody Reed, and, you know, there's no way to sugarcoat this. His first, four or five big league starts, just brutal. ERA slightly under 8.5. But on Tuesday, and yes, it's against the Braves, I understand, but nonetheless, two unearned runs through six innings. He looked very good. What was the difference for him Tuesday as opposed to those first four or five starts on a big league mound?
Well, that beginning of that start on Tuesday was possibly headed to Disasterville as well. He was gave up with some hard hits, they squared up the ball pretty hard, even if it was caught, and you're starting to wonder, well, boy, this could be another rough outing. And what he and Brian Price both said is that he slowed down. He finally kind of took control of himself. He breathed a little bit. He just kind of stopped rushing, and he was able for the last four innings of that start, really kind of get it together and use his slider effectively, throw his fastball really well for strikes, and not leave any fat pitches over the plate. And it really did work out. It was the first time he was able to leave a start with a lot of confidence, and since he came up, maybe his one first start when he was pitching pretty well. This has been something for him to build off of, and they're hoping certainly when he goes back out again that he can take what he did in the end of that start and bring it to the beginning of the next start.
And Mark, as we hear so often from even the most successful athletes in Major League Baseball, baseball is always a game of failure, and it's a tough thing even for guys with 10 years, 15 years under their belt to bounce back from failure and to pick yourself back up and be successful the next time around. But for a guy that does not have that kind of track record, for a guy that has not tasted any success at the big league level, how challenging was it for Cody Reed in particular to, again, here he is with all this potential, all this hype. He's done nothing in those first five starts. Did he get down on himself? Was it hard for him to kind of, keep that self-confidence that, I belong here and eventually I am going to get this thing turned around?
It certainly wasn't easy, but he's been very fortunate in one way, is that he's had a lot of teammates, veteran guys come up to him and let him know that his stuff does play in the major leagues, and that if he gets it together, that he could be very successful. He had guys like Joey Votto, Ross Ohlendorf, Jay Bruce, Zach Cozart coming up to him. Brian Price has only said that he's not going anywhere, that they haven't wavered on their confidence in him. They thought he was too good for AAA, but obviously the kind of stuff he had needed to be worked out, and that he could pitch in the major leagues and get major league hitters out. They saw it in spring training. They saw it, just from watching him in AAA and the reports, that he could do this. They feel like he can, and that's why Price has been like, he's not going anywhere, even when he's struggling. So they really they are behind him, and I think that might help him keep his confidence going forward.
Yeah, the vote of confidence always a positive thing, especially coming from veteran teammates, as is the case with Cody Reed. So it appears that his AAA days are firmly in the rearview mirror. We cannot say the same, though, for John Lamb. He was optioned to AAA after a very difficult outing last weekend. It appears that Homer Bailey is very close to returning. I believe he's got four rehab starts under his belt. When are we going to see Homer on the mound at GAB here, Mark?
Actually, he had his fifth start yesterday, threw 83 pitches at Louisville, and now we wait. They haven't decided yet if that's the last one or if he needs one more. They've always been kind of keeping that a fluid situation. They were, 83 pitches, though, is what he wanted. They wanted to get it up to that range before they activated him. I'm not sure if they might want to give him one more or not, just to make sure. It's kind of hinging on what they plan to do with the rotation. Now that Lamb is out, they have Kiva Sampson starting Saturday in a spot start. And then the next time through the rotation, that could be the spot where somewhere where Homer Bailey slides in. They have an off day as well, so they have some opportunity to manipulate the rotation to their liking. But we will find out going forward. I have a feeling he could be showing up at some time in that West Coast road trip next week, and then we'll see.
So it looks like the days are dwindling down, marking the return of Homer Bailey. That will happen hopefully sometime in the next week or two, if not sooner. And, Mark, unfortunately, been a very busy few days for a couple of Reds on the operating table. Give us some updates, if you could, on both John Moscott and Devin Mesoraco, too.
Yeah, Devin Mesoraco proved to be a rather surprising one because he's already been out for the season with a left non-throwing shoulder surgery that he had done in early May, late April. And then suddenly we learned that he had surgery to repair the right labrum in his hip. And he already had the left hip done a year ago. So what ended up happening is they spotted some of the same trends of degeneration of issues in the right hip that he had going into the left hip, and they decided to make this a preventative surgery. They did the soul searching. They looked at the scans and everything like that, and the doctor that did the surgery in New York City conferred with the team medical director of the Reds, and they said he absolutely 100% will need the surgery at some point. And if they had to do it next season, it would be three straight years of major surgery and not having Devin Mesoraco play. So they decided to go ahead and do that. Once his shoulder healed, and it's the shoulder is now able to go on crutches, so he can crutch around. And they still think he could be back and starting catching drills sometime in January. And they firmly believe that his catching days are not over. That's something that's been asked a few times, and they think that the left hip has performed nicely since that surgery, and that it's healed, and that the right one will do the same, and that it'll make him more athletic, more able to squat and move forward. And then as for John Moscott, he got demoted in June after struggling, and then he ended up hurting his elbow in early July this month. And after initially thinking it was just inflammation, it ended up being that he had the torn oral collateral ligament, and he had Tommy John surgery. And now, after missing all of last season with a separated left shoulder from a diving play, he's now out for this season and possibly next season with Tommy John surgery rehab. So it's been a really tough break for him.
Yeah, it's going to be a long road ahead for both for John Moscott in particular and Devin Mesoraco too, but at least things sound a little more encouraging where Mesoraco is concerned, given his immediate future for next year in Major League Baseball. Mark, let's kind of transition now since we did not get to speak during the All-Star break. Let's hand out some first half awards. We're going to hand out the Red Cy Young Award amongst starting pitchers. We'll hand out the MVP amongst position players, and then we'll get your opinion on the most unexpected development for this Reds team in the first half of the season. So, Mark, let's start with the Reds' first half, Cy Young, and I would tend to think that the front runner is a guy that we talked about at the onset of the podcast. Do you agree?
Well, it's a tough one because he only started the year in June. He's only had eight starts since he came back from the DL, and so Anthony DeSclafani would be my first half guy, but I wrote about it at the All-Star break that it was Brandon Finnegan, just because he made all his starts. He flirted with a no-hitter in April. He went toe-to-toe with Clayton Kershaw, a 1-0 complete game loss with Los Angeles. So by the pure measure of first half Cy Young, I have to give it to Finnegan, but certainly if you go up to today, whereas we're talking right now, I would give it to DeSclafani.
Yeah. Definitely a tough race there, but a close race, I should say. But as you said, Finnegan made all of his starts. He's been healthy all year. We cannot say that for Disco. So by the skin of his teeth, we're going to give that one to the lefty, Brandon Finnegan. And, Mark, I know that in the days leading up to this podcast, we discussed, let's try to hand out a bullpen award, the Raleigh Fingers Award, if you will. And you kind of put the kibosh on that, saying it's just the bullpen's been such a mess all year, and that's true that it's really hard for one guy to distinguish himself amongst the others for having an effective first half, because we've chronicled the problems of this bullpen. So let's modify this a little bit. Of the guys in the bullpen right now, who do you see breaking out, or who has perhaps broken out in recent weeks where you could see him at the end of the season being the top contributor to this revamped Reds bullpen?
I think without a doubt, Raisel Iglesias has been a shot in the arm, no pun intended, for the bullpen. He's come back in June. He had the shoulder problem. He was obviously the opening day starter, so him being in the bullpen was not part of the original arrangement. But out of necessity has come this, and he's been a very good contributor in the middle to the late innings for them, and he's given them some really nice length, some couple of two-inning relief appearances. He actually hasn't allowed a run in his last 11-plus innings.
Adam, thank you for joining us. I figured the Porter is so passe, why not call you a guru with Fitz, doesn't it?
Oh, I wouldn't go that far, but thank you.
Hey, I'm here to please. I'm here to please.
Yeah.
But, Adam, what we're going to do today is we're going to give out some first-half awards for this Milwaukee club. We'll give out, you know, the team MVP, the Cy Young, the top reliever, so on and so forth. But before we get there, let's talk about some recent developments as everybody now underway in the second half of the baseball season. And, Adam, one of baseball's oldest debates, if you will, kind of took center stage last night, Tuesday, in the Brewers' 3-2 loss to the Pirates at PNC. Now, Milwaukee ties the game at the top of the ninth against Pirates closer Mark Melancon. But in the home half of the ninth, it took Tyler Thornburg just one batter to let the game get away. He's on the hill, not the closer Jeremy Jeffress. And again, Josh Harrison hits the Little League home run, the triple and the error to give the Pirates the win. But again, you know, you hear it all the time, tie game, ninth inning on the road. Do you bring in your closer or do you not? Craig Counsell elects not to. It ends up backfiring if you know, put on your managerial shoes here for a few minutes. So what is your decision in that same scenario facing Counsell yesterday?
Well, in for Counsell, he's done it both ways. He has brought Jefferson in tie games on the road before a couple of times. And it's, as I, my memory thinks, it worked for him. I think the difference last night was you had arrested Thorne, who's been a really good reliever for this team. You know, he's got closer-type stuff. He's got the strikeout rate, certainly, of a closer. And I think because he was available and rested, it made more sense than they could, you know, quote-unquote, save Jeremy Jeffress for a save situation. So I think that's why he opted to do it that way last night. Obviously, Harrison gets him. Scott Thornburg also last year for a walk-off hit, so the Brewers lost the battle yesterday.
So, yeah, tough way to lose that one for the Brewers on Tuesday is, again, Tyler Thornburg, who's been very good all year. He's on the mound, not Jeremy Jeffress, and sometimes, you know, that'll get you. And it got the Brewers yesterday. They lose to the Pirates 3-2. Backtracking a little bit, it certainly appears, Adam, that Jimmy Nelson is rounding back into form. He had pretty much hit rock bottom back on June 15th, less than four innings. He gave up eight runs. But in the five starts since then, very quietly, an ERA under 2, 1.86 to be precise, and he really looked great in his most recent start against the Reds, and yes, it's the Reds, but nonetheless, seven scoreless innings in that one. What, in your mind, has been the biggest adjustment that Nelson has made over the course of the past month or so?
Well, I forget what's in my mind. I mean, I can tell you what he says was the difference, is that he worked with Derek Johnson, their pitching coach, on some mechanical stuff to get his legs back involved, his lower half. He felt like he had not been doing that. It led to some issues with his release point and not being on top of the ball properly. And it was, you know, creating some flat stuff that was getting hit pretty hard. And you're right. It's been a quiet a stretch of improvement for him. But that red start was by far his best outing. It was much more the Jimmy Nelson of May, where he was really good. And that's a big deal for the Brewers because they don't have Willie Peralta and they don't have Taylor Youngman. And Jimmy Nelson is kind of the best pitcher on this staff, stuff-wise, and they need him to get the results as such.
And he's certainly gotten those, and you mentioned the two guys who have been optioned to AAA in recent weeks, Willie Peralta and before that, Taylor Youngman. Any progress for those two on that front? I know they're in the thin air of Colorado Springs, but have we seen any sort of progression from those two as they look to get back to their former selves?
Well, Youngman's had some better outings lately, but they're not at AAA. They're at AA. They ended up sending him to Arizona, kind of regroup a little bit, and then sent him to AA Biloxi, where he can pitch in the heat and the humidity and against some lesser competition, get a little confidence back. And his outings have been better. I think Peralta is still stuck in the same stretch, though, where, you know, again, they're not just reading the box. You can't just read the box scores at Colorado Springs. You have to look inside the outings, and they're looking for things in these outings to feel good about. The velocity is there. The arm strength is definitely there. The results yet have not been there, so I don't think a return is imminent.
Okay, and moving on to some injury updates, Adam, on both Domingo Santana and Chris Capuano. What seems like, from what you wrote, one player progressing nicely and another player not so much. Kind of break that down for us.
Yeah, I mean, Capuano's the one, not so much. He had a PRP injection in his arm and his elbow. He just had not been progressing, and there's legit concern there. I mean, this is a guy who's 37 years old, and he's had two Tommy Johns, and now he's dealing with a flexor tendon strain, which is sometimes a red flag. So the number one is to get the inflammation out of there, let him throw again and see where he's at, and they are in the process now of coming back from that injection. But Domingo Santana is much more promising. They hope to have him back out on a rehab assignment by the end of this week, and then they're going to take their time. It's going to be, you know, an extended stretch, meaning more than a week at least, to test his elbow and his shoulder. He's had problems with both this season. Let him air out some throws, make sure he's totally healthy before he comes back. They could really use his bat if it's anything like it was in the second half last season, where he gave him some pretty good slug. They've not had that out of center and right field. It's been not very good at all offensively, and Domingo Santana could boost that.
He certainly could, and considering that, you know, rampant speculation that two of the biggest bats, if not the two biggest bats on the team, Jonathan Lucroy and Ryan Braun, could be elsewhere in the coming weeks with the trade deadline approaching rapidly on August 1st. Adam, let's transition here to give out some first-half awards for this Brewers club. We're going to give out the Cy Young, the Raleigh Fingers Award for top reliever. Also give out the MVP for position players and the most unexpected development of the first half of the Brew Crew season. So let's start off with the Cy Young Award. I'm going to offer my guesses, try to get into your head a little bit. I'm guessing it's going to come down between either Jimmy Nelson or perhaps Junior Guerra. Do one of those two guys get your award?
Yeah, Junior Guerra for sure. What a great story. He's a rookie. He happens to be a 31-year-old rookie. And pitched all over the world before finding a home in affiliated ball again with the White Sox last year as a reliever. The Brewers brought him up as a starter, and he has been really, really good. He's pitched, I think, both of their 1-0 wins. He's pitched in most of their shutouts. He's been by far their best starting pitcher. He does it with mostly a splitter, a pitch that opposing hitters don't see very often, a big swing and miss pitch. And the test is going to be, let's see what, once he starts facing some division foes multiple times, how does that play? The Brewers think it'll play well because it's a big pitch. And, you know, I think he's a really, really interesting guy. As Craig Counsell says, pitching comes from all places. And Junior Guerra is one that happened to come from Italy and Venezuela and independent leagues. And here he is really helping out a starting staff that needs it.
Yeah, it's amazing where you find help sometimes. Like you said, this guy is a rookie, you know, technically, but a 31-year-old rookie, and what a find he's been for this Brewers team. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe of his 14 starts this year, 11, he's given up three earned runs or less. So that's great stuff right there. That is ace-level material, and he's been something else for the Brewers this year. Transitioning now, Adam, to the Raleigh Fingers Award for relievers. We've talked already at length about Thornburg and Jeremy Jeffress at, you know, throughout the podcast, and my guess is that this award has to go to either one of those two, correct?
Yeah, it's Jeffress. I mean, remember, the Brewers were going to go with co-closers coming into the year with Jeffress and Will Smith, a lefty-righty situation. Neither had extensive experience as a closer, so there were, you know, there's some question until a guy gets in that ninth inning, how's he going to handle it? And Will Smith goes down in spring with a knee injury, missed 2 months, and Jeremy Jeffress has been really good. He is a big-time trade candidate along with Will Smith. If you look at it, Chapman and Miller from the Yankees are kind of the top two guys that are out there. If the Yankees hold, I think the Brewers have the two next best things in Smith and Jeffress, and it's a credit, I think, to Jeremy Jeffress that he grabbed that role and has really succeeded at it. His value has never been higher.
Adam, we thank you for the time, and the Bucks coming off a thrilling victory last night over Milwaukee. Josh Harrison did the 360 around the bases to lead off the bottom of the ninth. The triple and the error gave the Pirates a 3-2 win after Mark Melanson had blown the save in the top half of the ninth. So, again, Jay Hay the hero, but I think the night really belonged to Jameson Taillon. He comes off the DL, and I'm convinced after what happened last night, the guy's skull might be made of titanium. I mean, 105 miles an hour off the bat, Hernan Perez, very terrifying to watch, but Taillon down for a little bit, shakes it off, and not only pitches four more innings, but four very good innings. Six innings of a one-run ball for Taillon, and I mean, we say guys are tough all the time, but I mean, tough does not even begin to describe what Taillon did last night, in my opinion.
Yeah, tough and a little bit lucky, I think is probably fair to say. Tyone, so like you said, took that ball off the back of his head. He still had stitch marks from the baseball on the back of his cap. He showed us that today, just sort of like up and to the right of the Major League Baseball logo on the bottom, the base of his cap. So that just shows you how potentially serious that situation was. But he got up really quickly. He was back, you know, insisted on throwing. Head athletic trainer Todd Tomczyk said he was looking for reasons to take him out of the game, obviously, just given the, you know, the sensitive issue of concussions in sports and just the concern for the young man and the player. But they couldn't find any. Tyone passed every test. He showed up today. Everything's fine. No red flag symptoms or anything like that. So it seems like Tyone really escaped the worst. And then, yeah, the weird part of it was just that he continued to pitch so well, maybe even better after, you know, he was hit in the head than he did before. He said he had some adrenaline after that, but, you know, settled down, pitched six really efficient innings on 65 pitches. Another good start for him, but the more important thing at this point is just that he seems to be healthy and appears to have kind of escaped what could have been a really scary situation.
No question there. And one of the best scenes from that whole thing last night was the standing O, a raucous standing O he got from the faithful at PNC Park, where the fans realized that, you know, oh my goodness, he's remaining in the game after, you know, being flat on the ground and taking a line drive off the head. Remarkable scene last night. Remarkable job done by Jameson Tyone as he settles for a no decision, but pitched very well. Six innings of one run ball and one line drive off the head, as you mentioned. And another guy that came off the DL, his first appearance in well over a month, Francisco Cervelli, first appearance since June 10th. And, you know, Adam, he's not one of the marquee names on this team, but in your opinion, is he one of those guys whose importance to the team perhaps goes a bit unnoticed or under the radar at times?
Yeah, it's really hard to state, just given the importance of the catcher in what the Pirates do as far as, you know, game calling and pitch framing and, you know, working with the staff and everything like that. Just that Cervelli is so important to this team in that regard. But he's also a really important offensive presence. You know, the average is going to catch your eye if it is like it was last year. But this season, you know, it wasn't at the same level before he went hurt. But the on-base percentage is just still so solid, and the at-bats are so tough. You saw that a little bit last night. He, you know, he worked a pretty good at-bat and got a sacrifice fly to give the Pirates a second run in the first inning. Then he worked a walk later in the game. He's, you know, he's a really important attitude, kind of just a person to have around the clubhouse as well. So the Pirates are obviously a lot better off with him, you know, back behind the plate and in their lineup. Not that, you know, Eric Kratz didn't do a fine job handling the pitching staff while he was here. And Eric Fryer actually looks like a pretty viable backup option if Chris Stewart isn't able to come back anytime soon. So, you know, the Pirates were able to bridge sort of that gap while Cervelli was down, but there's no question they're a better team with him around, and that's why they, you know, gave him a three-year contract extension at the beginning of the season, because they value, you know, the things that he does and the person that he brings to their clubhouse.
Yeah, I think people often forget that the success of a pitching staff, the guy that has a very key role in that success is the catcher, the guy behind the plate, calling the shots, if you will. So to have Cervelli back is certainly a good thing for this Pirates team. And Adam, again, we touched on it a little bit, but Mark Melancon now two consecutive blown saves. The Pirates got him out of hot water last night as the, you know, the Pirates win the game, obviously. But, you know, look, everybody's human. Everybody slumps. Melancon is as good as they come in baseball. Any concern here, or is it just a guy, like I said, going through a little bit of a tough stretch right now?
Yeah, I don't think there's any real concern over that. You know, it was two outs, two strikes both times on Sunday with the Daniel Murphy homer, and then last night with the RBI single. So, you know, if Melancon had blown those two saves, you know, 3 weeks apart, I don't think there would be any concern. You'd just say, well, you know, it kind of happened. And, you know, it's just sort of clustered together, which makes it seem a little more pressing. But no, I don't think there's any underlying concern with Melancon at this point. He's been so efficient, so good, so reliable. Even over the first half of this season, he didn't quite have the struggles that he had, you know, to start last year even. So I don't think there's any reason to worry about Melancon at this point, just based off of two nights.
Yeah, I think on the list of concerns for this team, Mark Melancon is very, very low on that list, and no reason to think that he won't bounce back and do so quickly. You brought up that marathon ball game on Sunday, I believe, in Washington. Melancon one strike away from giving the Pirates a 1-0 win. Daniel Murphy comes off the bench, belts a game-tying homer, and next thing you know, 9 more innings overplayed, so 2 games rolled into 1. Were you at Washington that day covering the game? And if so, how much were you cursing Daniel Murphy's name under your breath?
No, I picked a good one to be off, or rather our boss just picked a good one to have me off. But I was telling my colleagues who did cover that game that I covered an even longer game. It was, I think it was 19 innings, 6 hours and 54 minutes at Tropicana Field, and that was a night game. At least those guys on Sunday had a day game. You know, the sun was still shining, I think, when they left the ballpark.
Yeah, what year was that? Almost 7 hours against the Rays.
Oh, I think it was either 2013 or 14. It would have been when I was back in Tampa Bay. So recently, David DeJesus, I think, had the game-winning hit in that one. I just remember the guys were wearing, you know, it was the Rays, so they were doing all sorts of wacky stuff. They were wearing Chewbacca and Gene Simmons masks in the dugout. They were bringing food out. It's just sort of, you know, the way you embrace those crazy long games if you can.
Jennifer, thank you very much for the time, and let's dive right in. The Cardinals rained out on Tuesday as we speak. They're in the midst of a day-night twin bill against the San Diego Padres, but there was some big news earlier in the day on Tuesday. Johnny Peralta back on the DL due to a ligament strain in his left thumb, the same thumb that he underwent surgery on, which knocked him out for 50-plus games, I believe, earlier in the season. Now, this obviously is going to have or has already had a huge domino effect on the roster, as well as the infield configuration for at least the next couple of weeks, however long that Peralta is going to be on the shelf. So, Jennifer, just start off by breaking down all the player shuffling on the roster and on the infield resulting from this latest setback for Johnny Peralta.
Yeah, I mean, you look right now on the disabled list, and the Cardinals starting first baseman Brandon Moss, they're starting second baseman Matt Carpenter, and now they're starting third baseman Johnny Peralta, all on that disabled list. I mean, the good news is that the Cardinals don't think that any of those stays will be that extended as it pertains to Peralta. This is the same thumb he had surgery on. The Cardinals don't believe this is necessarily related to the surgery, though it's hard to believe that there's probably not some correlation there, even just with the strength that he's trying to regain in that thumb. But the hope is that with 7 to 10 days of rest, after that, kind of the inflammation and the soreness that Johnny's been dealing with, he can then resume baseball activities. And the Cardinals hope that, you know, the minimum 15 days is all that he would need, which would put his return in early August. They hope that Brandon Moss could be a little bit before that, and maybe Matt Carpenter just shortly after that. But what it means now is it means we're going to see more of Greg Garcia. We're going to see more of Jed Jerko. And also Colton Wong. I mean, all those guys are going to kind of mix and match as Mike Matheny wants them to fill those spots in the meantime. One thing I thought was interesting yesterday in addressing this injury to Peralta, general manager John Mozeliak said that this does not necessarily change the team's plans at the trade deadline. They're not all of a sudden going to start looking for infield help, and that's mostly because they do expect these guys to be back by early August. So disappointing setback for Johnny, certainly, and you do wonder if this might turn out to be somewhat of a lost season for him. Even when he had been healthy over the last month plus, we hadn't really seen much power from him, and I think that the strength coming back in his thumb is a slow process. So the Cardinals hope to get him back, hope for that boost, but right now he's just resting and trying to get that thumb strong again.
And Jennifer, you mentioned something interesting in that, John Mozeliak insisted that this setback for his left thumb is completely unrelated to the original setback for his left thumb, which he underwent surgery on. Now, I think that anybody that reads that at first is going to be a little bit skeptical. It sounds like you are too, and I just have a hard time believing that the two are not connected in some fashion, don't you?
Yeah, I do. And I mean, they say that it's the other side of the thumb, but the issue, you know, he had ligament thumb surgery in March, and this is a ligament strain. And so there seems to be some correlation there. I mean, he did twice in the past couple weeks during swings is when he aggravated that ligament again. But I do think a lot of it, again, I think a lot of it has to do with just regaining the strength in that thumb. I mean, he's probably not going to be fully there this whole year. I mean, this might be something that he just tries to get right for next year. But my guess is that just a little bit of weakness made it a little bit more exposed when he took those swings, and here all of a sudden now he's had a setback. And let's not forget, this is the same surgery that Yadi Molina had this offseason, and it took him 2 surgeries to get that thumb right. So it's not something that you necessarily come back quickly back to 100% from right away.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough road for Johnny Peralta. You brought up the great example with Yadi Molina. This is not an easy thing to bounce back from. A lot of recovery time, even post-surgery. So we'll see. As you said, this could just be a lost 2016 season for Johnny Peralta. Briefly, Jennifer, you mentioned that Colton Wong is obviously going to be in the mix along with Greg Garcia and Jed Jerko, some other guys in this brand-new infield configuration, at least for the foreseeable future. Should we expect to see Wong every day or nearly every day at his former second base position, or does he still bounce back and forth between the outfield and the infield?
I think right now when he plays, it's probably going to be mostly a second base. And that's credit to Randall Grichuk, who since coming up about a week before the All-Star break has played very well, reached base, I believe, in every game since then. So he's going to continue to get the playing time in center field, which then shuffles Colton Wong back to his natural second base position. I do think the Cardinals, what we've seen out of this All-Star break, is that they're willing to platoon he and Jed Jerko at second base, you know, the right-handed and the left-handed versus the matchup. But whoever gets hot is going to play. You know, unfortunately for Colton Wong, but fortunate for the Cardinals, is Jed Jerko has killed his former team, the San Diego Padres. That's why we've seen him continue to start daily in this series. But Colton Wong is going to get his opportunities. And I think, you know, as the Cardinals buy time for some of these veteran bats to get healthy, a guy like Colton, somebody like Randall Grichuk, Matt Adams, some of these players who have had up and down first halves, big for the Cardinals if they can come out strong to start the second half and kind of maybe gain a little bit of that traction that they lacked earlier this year. Because if the Cardinals want this offense to continue to click, especially without Matt Carpenter and even Brandon Moss, they're going to have to get contributions elsewhere, and Colton's going to be a big part of that.
All right, so Jennifer, let's shift to something a little more uplifting as all this injury talk. Let's do something else now, something better. And something better certainly is Alex Reyes going back to the Futures game during All-Star Week in San Diego. And Reyes, the top prospect for the Cardinals, definitely turned some heads at that Futures game by basically doing what he's done all along. The book on him is he trolls hard, strikes out a ton of guys, also a tad wild. He checked off all three boxes at the Futures game. What do you think the immediate future holds for Reyes in terms of a big league promotion? I know that John Mozeliak has not been shy in discussing that, you know what, this guy isn't our plans. We just haven't completely nailed down on what his role is going to be quite yet.
Yeah, it's interesting because as we approach the trade deadline, it's no secret that the Cardinals are looking for bullpen help. And, you know, you do wonder if perhaps their best bullpen help is sitting down there in the AAA rotation in Alex Reyes. And we've seen the Cardinals do this before. I mean, look at what they did with Carlos Martinez a couple of years back. He was a starter all the way through the minors. They brought him up initially. He pitched out of the bullpen, was electric in a seventh, eighth inning role, very effective in the postseason. And then he converted back into a starter. Now we see him as a dynamic part of the St. Louis Cardinals rotation. That being said, the Cardinals and general manager John Mozeliak in particular seem ready to be patient with Alex Reyes and at this point want to leave him in AAA. For Alex, you know, the big thing for him, I think, over these next couple weeks, he's got to get more efficient. And while that's not necessarily a reason for concern if the Cardinals were to need him in a relief role, if they do want him to start, he's not going to be able to throw 100 pitches over five innings and expect to make it very long in a major league rotation. So for now, he's going to continue to pitch every 5 days. Work on that pitch efficiency, work to decrease the walk rate, throw more strikes. I mean, what we saw at the Futures game was electric. And we saw this kid strike out, threw two pitches at 101, strike out somebody on a fastball, strike out somebody on a changeup, strike out somebody on a curveball. I mean, all his pitches are there. It's just kind of honing them all in. And it will be interesting to see if he does eventually come up and help this team in the bullpen. I think some of that will be dictated by whether or not the Cardinals can find some bullpen help externally in the next 12 days. But he's certainly sitting down there as an option, and I think a pretty good one if the Cardinals need some help.